City, Colorado Springs, Colorado. This is the USA Volleyball Show. And here are your hosts, Clarence Hughes and Stephen Munson.
Hello and welcome to the USA Volleyball Show, the official podcast of USA Volleyball. My name is Stephen Munson, one of the hosts on the podcast, flying solo today. Clarence Hughes is out on meetings. We're preparing here at USA Volleyball for the upcoming season for 2024. So a lot of meetings, a lot of budget meetings going on. So he is unfortunately not here, but we have a great episode ahead for you. So I'm just going to dive right in. But before we do, if you haven't already listened or watched episode 75, you can do that now. We sit down with Donnie Huey, aka Coach Donnie. Donnie is huge in the volleyball community, from coaching, playing, training, jumping, YouTubing, content creating. He does it all. Coach Donnie has been competing at USA Volleyball Open National Championships for several years now with his team, Tall Ones. Coach Donnie runs a successful strength training, jump training, volleyball training organization called Elevate Yourself, where Coach Donnie shares all sorts of volleyball and training videos, tons of resources there. So check that out. Really insightful, great conversation with Donnie in that episode. So you'll want to go back and listen to that, to episode 75 with Coach Donnie, or you can watch that episode on USA Volleyball's YouTube channel. But without Clarence Hughes, we're going to go in to the news with Hughes, without Hughes. Here we go. Congratulations to the U.S. men's national team for finishing undefeated in their pool at the FIVB Road to Paris Olympic qualifier, and in doing so, punched their ticket to the Paris 2024 Olympic Games. In addition to that, they were awarded the World Cup trophy. The last time the U.S. men won the cup was in 2015. If you were watching the U.S. men compete in the Road to Paris Olympic qualifier, you may have seen outside hitter TJ DeFalco sporting a new tattoo sleeve. Well, communications manager BJ Evans got the scoop on all the different pieces of that tattoo and what each one means. You can read the full story on usavolleyball.org. Over on the beach, friend of the pod, Kelly Chang, and her partner, Sarah Hughes, won the FIVB Beach World Championship in Tlaxcala, Mexico. The gold medal guarantees a berth for the U.S. women's beach teams at the Paris 2024 Olympic Games. Recent podcast guests Kristen Nuss and Taryn Cloth took bronze at the event, and another former guest, Trevor Crabb, and his partner, Theo Brunner, finished fourth on the men's side. Another congratulations to Corinne Quiggle and Sarah Murphy for winning the AVP Laguna Beach Open ahead of them heading out to the Pan American Games. Always great to see our USA athletes bringing home some hardware. Some overseas news with Hughes, without Hughes. Congratulations to Jordan Thompson, Chiaka Obogu, and Ali Franti for heading straight to play with their Turkish club team following their season with USA. They qualified for the Paris Olympic Games with USA. But straight off of that, they won the Super Cup with their Turkish club, and Jordan Thompson was also named MVP. A reminder to all volleyball fans, Athletes Unlimited Season 3 is underway. They will begin competing, or they are competing, in Mesa, Arizona from October 6th through November 6th at Bell Bank Park in Mesa, Arizona. Mark your calendars and get your tickets now. If you can't make it in person, be sure to tune in. They'll be airing these matches on ESPN Plus and ESPNU. For all other action, tune in to USA Volleyball social medias. And for more on the latest news, visit usavolleyball.org. Now, let's just jump right in. We have a great guest, a great episode coming up. We sit down with U.S. women's sitting national team head coach, Bill Hameter. Great conversation talking about his background, his involvement with the sitting and Paralympic programs from their beginning to where they are now, and get a little bit, know a little bit more about his interests and hobbies outside of volleyball as well. But enough from us. Here is Bill. Good morning, Bill. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us. Really excited to have you on the podcast. This is episode 76, and I'm shocked that we're just now getting you on the podcast. So I'm excited to get to know a little bit more about your background, talk about your involvement with the sitting programs, and yeah, just have a great conversation with you today. Thank you again.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I know schedules are tough and everything's busy, so it's probably more my side than y'all's for sure, but at least now we figured it out.
Yeah, and I'm talking about busy schedules, you just had or maybe right in the middle of a training camp there in Oklahoma. How did that go? Was it with both men's and women's sitting programs, or was it just the sitting women's sitting program? How'd that go?
Yeah. We just finished the women's camp on Sunday. And it went pretty well. I mean, we were going through the finishing touches of preparations for the World Cup, stuff like that. So working on systems and personnel types of stuff, a little bit of tactics, but more just about execution and that kind of stuff. It was pretty good.
So coming off Tokyo Gold, what's the focus coming into those training camps? Is it you kind of clean slate, look ahead to Paris, set new goals? What's kind of the focus when you go into those training camps?
Well, it's different now than what it had been. The year after Tokyo was really busy because of the shortened quad, that normally the way that we schedule things out, we were having to do multiple things within that year. The other part is we had several of our athletes go on maternity leave, and we've had two or three with injuries or surgery, stuff like that. So, all those types of things change what you're trying to accomplish in a camp and stuff like that. A lot of it for us, at the beginning and out the bat was, all right, let's relook at our personnel. What systems are we setting up? Will that system operate with the personnel that we have? All those types of things that you go through. We felt like we were in some pretty good place, and then had two key injuries, and that changed everything last year for some stuff. We went into the World Championships last November still without two players that were on maternity leave, and two players that were just getting back from maternity leave, and two players that literally were just a week or two out from returning from rehab from surgery. So it was a difficult tournament to prepare for and that kind of stuff. Now, then we step into this year. I think, lessons learned from some of the World Championships and stuff like that. We tweaked and changed a few things going into the Zone Championship. Win the Zone Championship to be able to qualify for Paris. And then now that totally changes everything that you look at. It's always that first goal is, what do we have to do to qualify? And so it's all that preparations, those kind of things. World Championships for us has always been one of those things. You want to do the best as you can. You're trying to win, but it's always been one of those, an event that we are trying to work out a lot of details and look at some things of, all right, what are our next 2 years going to look like, you know, getting data and information, stuff like that. You know, and previously, the last couple of quads, we've been able to qualify at the World Championships. We didn't this year, but, you know, we still qualified in May at the Paralympics. So it's still pretty early. So then that helped us now to where then, you know, we began to look at player development, trying to get more reps into players. You know, some players that are needing some more rehab, that type of stuff to get ready for next year. You know, you just start looking at all those types of details. You know, specifically like the last few camps, you know, we got 80 bridge back off of maternity leave.
Yep.
So it means we only have one still maternity leave, but, you know, we tried to get her back into the scheme of things, stuff like that. But, you know, after the zone championship, then after the Dutch tournament, some stuff, then we were focused on World Cup and the, you know, biggest thing there was just trying to look at how we were going to play some of our personnel when we're making any changes to our system, stuff like that. But, you know, our team responded pretty well to that. Like three camps ago, I said, well, this is probably the best camp that we've had in 3 or 4 years. And then we followed that up two camps ago where I was like, well, this one's even better than the last. And then camp last week went pretty well again. So, you know, I think some of that's that we're starting to get things together, peeking out, you know, getting in the flow. Probably way more information than what you wanted on that.
No, thank you for sharing that. It's so interesting, especially for a program that's had so much success to, you know, understand what's going through your mind as a coach as you prepare for those camps. And like you said, a shorter quad preparing for Paris now. And I should have mentioned at the start of this, congratulations on qualifying for Paris. And and the team, they're doing really well. And excited. I want to know more about your the development of some of these newer players, especially as you mentioned with some players being out with injury and maternity leave. I want to get into that. I want to get into World Cup prep, but let's start off with just kind of going into your background a little bit. Tell me about your involvement with the sitting programs, the Paralympic side of the sport, you know, both with men's and women's, and kind of your, how your role has kind of evolved over time.
Well, I started with the Paralympic program in 2001. You know, before that, I had coached volleyball. I coached collegiately, and I had worked with national team program stuff there at USA Volleyball with some of the on the developmental side, like with the youth national teams and some of that kind of stuff. So, 2001, John Kessel called me and said, hey, you interested in coaching our Paralympic team? And at that time, we only had a men's team. And I was like, well, I don't know. I've never seen the game played. I really don't know much about it. So I still don't remember how he twisted my arm and got me to say yes. But, you know, at that time, it was just a very part-time position. You know, was not funded well at all. Part of the reason why the USA Volleyball was looking for a coach was that before the men's team actually was underneath another organization. It was with the Disabled Sports Organization. And with the update in the Amateur Sports Act, the Congress basically told the USOPC that they needed to treat the Paralympic athletes like they do the Olympic athletes and our teams. And then in 2000 was the Sydney Games. Congress came back after that and said, you're not anywhere close to doing what you need to be doing for these Paralympic athletes. So that's when things started to change. So they moved the team from that other organization over to USA Volleyball. And at that time, USA Volleyball was just a managing partner. The team was actually underneath the USOPC still. But anyway, that's kind of how I got into it. And then it was a learning process from there for me. I had I had the volleyball background. I have a master's degree in kinesiology with an emphasis, it's education kinesiology. So I had the science background, and a part of what I did in my master's program was with adaptive sports. So it gave me some side of, understanding what I needed to do and look at or whatever. But, man, when I got into it, like anything, it's totally different than what you think. We began there and started to, develop the team, stuff like that. The team had not been very successful in the past. I thought we did a good job at trying to retain some players, finding some new players, kind of building a new program. Although we still really didn't have a program because, we practice maybe every other month, something like that. We won the zone championship. That qualified us for, the Athens Games. So we were able to get to the Athens Games, which was, a highlight there. But it was actually there that after the Athens Games that I came to the realization, all right, if this team's ever going to be any good, we've got to train more, and we need some type of a resident program or something like that. The women had started the program for Athens as well under, a different coach. But they had success, won the bronze. In fact, I was telling some in USA Volleyball, next year is going to be the 20th anniversary of that first Paralympics and of the first.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a big deal. But they kind of got some things started there, but they were in a little bit of the same boat. Hey, what do we do? How do we train more? Things like that. So we really didn't have any direction to go very much. I talked to Kerry Klosterman that worked for USA Volleyball at that time. And said, hey, what can we do to try to find a place to host us? And, we began looking at some stuff, RFPs, and going about it. And, we were able to work a deal out with the University of Central Oklahoma, especially because they had done and still do a lot of programming with adaptive sports and stuff like that. So it's been our home since 2005. And we began small with one person training. I was still had another full-time job and everything else so kind of went through, that transition, getting some more people into that program, men and women that were here trained together because there just weren't enough, people at that time. Then 2009 is when things really started to happen. I would have told you in 2008, you know, we'll never have a full-time position in, you know, sitting volleyball. But at the early beginnings of 2009, USA Volleyball was able to put together a package between three different organizations, UCO, the USOPC, and USA Volleyball all went together to package a deal to hire me. And so, I was able to, start full time in 2009. And that's really when we started building the program. Like I said, we'd started a resident program and it was kind of hit and miss a little bit on some things, structure and all that. But, they hired me in 2009, they hired me as the director for the program, also the women's head coach and also the men's head coach. So I was at a kind of a three-tiered role there.
Yeah.
But we also had Elliot Blake that was, he had been working, was employed by UCO actually to be, to work with the sitting programs and some stuff. So like that. So, we were able to incorporate, him into some of the stuff that we were doing as well, especially on the development side, which is what he still does. And, that's kind of how we got things started from there and have just continued to build, been able to add staff. We've been able to get USA Volleyball to become our national governing body officially, all those types of things. So it's been a good ride.
Yeah, what a journey for you, especially just to be able to see that from, its early stages all the way to where it is now, and it's continuing to grow. And you mentioned the development side with Elliot Blake, and that program is also growing a lot. And you're seeing some of those athletes now trickle into the national team, the senior national team part, which is really cool to see. And yeah, like especially for you to see that program grow from its early beginnings to where it is now. And you have a host city as well, a host facility. So yeah, that's awesome. And you and I actually had a similar path early on in coaching where John Kessel, when I first started at USA Volleyball, John Kessel brought me into his office and pretty much told me, hey, you're coaching a club volleyball team. So he somehow twisted my arm to get into coaching as well. You have had a lot more success than I have in coaching, but I thought that was funny that we had the same little intro there. That's funny. John Kessel's great. Any listeners who don't know John Kessel, Google him, search on our website. You'll find a wealth of volleyball knowledge from grassroots to coaching. You'll get sucked into a black hole of great resources. So definitely check that out.
Sure. Yeah.
Tell me about, how you kind of alluded to it, but how important it is to have a host facility like UCO, from the training rooms, from the courts that they have, all the resources that they provide. How important is that for the programs and for the success of the programs?
Yeah, been very, very important for us. I don't think we would have had the success that we've had without having the backing of UCO. In a lot of different respects, but the key element there for all of it was because the U.S. is so large, it's been very difficult for us to try to put together a sitting volleyball league. And, we've had a hard time trying to get a indoor, league, professional league going. So,
right.
The sitting's kind of following suit that way. So, it's been something as we're looking at, how do we develop players? How do we resource them, train them, all those types of things? And that's the reason I kind of fell on the resident program side of things, so that we had a host. You know, on the women's side, we may have a little bit easier time in from this standpoint. Because of Title IX, there's just so many females playing the sport of volleyball that out of those large numbers, there are, you know, players with disabilities that are playing standing volleyball. And so whether it be high school, club ball, whatever. So then it's the impetus on us is just to try to find those athletes and then transition them to the floor. You know, they've learned the game. They have reps under them because they've had to get that to play, things like that. And so, you know, there's some slight nuance differences to the sitting game that they have to learn. The moving part's the worst, you know, or the hardest for them and all. But that's relatively easier than on the men's side, which is we have very few athletes that have played the game already that then transition to us. And so what we have to do usually is we have to find good athletes and then make them into volleyball players. Well, to do that, we have to have a place that we can train and put more hours into them than just, you know, somebody attending a few camps here and there as we go. And that's been the biggest key of our resident program is, you know, being able to get athletes to come in to train full time. You know, we train 5 days a week on our skill training. You know, we do our weightlifting, all that kind of stuff. And it's all year. So nothing really official as far as research, but I can just tell you from my perspective, you know, if you can give me an athlete into the resident program for 1 year, I can get them to the place in that 1 year that it would take a player just coming to camps that it would take them 4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
So that's a huge advantage.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense just to have that full-time facility where you can have those resident athletes here, there, you know, all year round, have athletes who live out of state who can come for, you know, a few weeks, a month out of the time, out of their year, right, to get that consistent training with the program. So, yeah, that makes total sense.
You know, had it where we have some, UCO gives us some scholarship money. So if players.
Awesome.
You know, that are right out of high school, when they come to college, they can come to college as well.
Oh, cool.
And get some tuition money. It's not a bunch, but at least it helps some, you know. But then that way they can go to school, stay in our housing, that kind of stuff, train and go to school. So, you know, it can be beneficial, you know, that way as well.
That's awesome. I didn't know about that. That's really cool that they offer that. You kind of alluded to it in your background, but you coached club volleyball as well before you were kind of involved with the sitting programs. You founded two clubs in Oklahoma, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, but can you talk a little bit? What were those clubs? Can you talk a little bit about being, you know, club director for club volleyball?
Yeah, well, Oklahoma was a little bit behind in volleyball when I got started. And I actually moved from Texas to Oklahoma to coach a college team, Southern Nazarene University. And so when I got here and started, I was like, wow, not much going on. They did have a high school program and stuff, but their season was in the springtime instead of the fall.
Okay. Yeah.
And so it wasn't until 1997 91 that changed, and they switched it to the fall season. So in the meantime, I moved here to Oklahoma in 87 thinking, hey, I'll be here 4 or 5 years. lo and behold, I'm still here. But, you know, I started looking at it as like, hey, we need to start some kind of a training program. And so I actually started, you know, the club. It went through several different names, but it ended up, it was called Oklahoma Wind Volleyball Club. It was basically really the first club in Oklahoma at that time. There had been some high school teams that played some club ball, just because it was kind of during their season type of a thing, you know, but,
right.
As we looked at that, but my first team that we put together, it was, you know, we used the university's gymnasium. We used the university's balls. I think if I remember correctly, it was a 16 and under team. And that's because our oldest player was 16. You know, everybody else.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
15, 14s. It was whatever we could find to get them together to play.
Yep.
That's kind of how we started, you know. And, you know, at that time, you know, we weren't great, but we, you know, put some things together and kind of kept growing and building. And, you know, it really helped whenever we changed the high school season to the fall, you know, because then we had that, the spring and stuff for club ball, and that really helped us. You know, so Oklahoma Wind, basically like almost any other club, you know, we began to grow and get new players in, you know, and started with all the different age divisions. We started a pretty large tournament here in Oklahoma called Redland Rendezvous at the time. And that tournament continues to go to this day, even though the club isn't functioning any longer. That tournament was actually sold to a different organization that they operate now.
That's cool.
Yeah, so, you know, we just started a lot of that kind of stuff, got a lot of players started playing the game. And now, you know, from a director standpoint, there were a lot of hours put into it for sure, but I think it was well worth it. You know, and then as I went through some things, actually 2001, you know, started with the sitting program. It was just too much going on, and I was like, yeah, I really can't do this. So I kind of backed out of some of that, only to get a nucleus of some other guys that were coaches that we said, hey, we want to start a higher level club. So fewer teams at the time, you know, trying to focus on higher level. So we put together another club called the Oklahoma Peak Performance, or yep. OP2. Which is still ongoing. At that time, we were an LLC. Now it's turned over into a nonprofit. But so I started in as a club director for that. And again, kind of the same thing, just you know, trying to find the coaches, players, and for several years, basically, we just had, you know, two teams and a few age groups. And, you know, we continue to kind of build up in the age groups. And, you know, now I no longer coach really there. I'm still on the board of directors for the club. I think we have like 31 teams, something like that now.
Oh, awesome.
And, you know, very, very successful program. We just kicked off the plans last month. We're building a brand new 10-court facility here in Oklahoma City. Supposed to be ready next year.
Oh, cool. Congratulations.
So, yeah. So, yeah, a lot of different things happening there. You know, it's good to still be a part of that, but just so much going on, so busy. I mean, with my role as director and as head coach, it just too much going on to try to keep coaching and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the other part, a lot of people don't know, I'm also the board president of the Oklahoma Region Volleyball Association.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I help oversee the region operations and that kind of stuff as well. I mean, we have Sean McCarty is our commissioner, you know, that does all the day-to-day stuff. But, yeah, anyway, it's another big task. So
a lot of hats.
Yeah, a lot going on. But
do you have an extra day in your week? What's your secret there?
Yeah, I don't know. Just putting way too much time, I think, is the biggest thing. But, you know, the club ball really afforded me a lot to be able to – I mean, I coached everything from, you know, 18 and unders to 12 and unders. And even in 12 and unders, I coached a 12-2 team, a beginners, you know, type of team. And it really helped me to see a big perspective of the development of players. How do you do that? How can you set up structures of that? What are those processes to bring those players along in development and training? You know, a lot of background within that. And, you know, I think it also, it gave me a good background just with in Oklahoma as far as club ball, high school ball, college ball. You know, I know a lot of coaches here in the state now since I've been here, you know, since 87. So
that's awesome. Do you have any, you've seen the programs, you know, go from the beginning to the end or to where they are now? You are kind of taking a step back, but you still kind of watch the programs and what they're doing. Do you have any, you know, favorite memories from, you know, whether that's being a coach for club or club director, or even now just kind of sitting on the board, taking that step back, any favorite memories you have in the club scene?
Well, I think, you know, some of that, some of those good memories are the ones where you take a team, you qualify for JO Nationals.
Yep.
Especially in the early days when, like I said, we were piecing 3 and 4 age groups to make one team, you know. And to start in that kind of development and see some of that success, you know, taking a team that probably had no business winning the regionals to qualify for JOs, but, you know, having it happen, you know, those are the kind of memories you look back on. But, you know, more than anything else, I think it's maybe a cliche type of thing, but, you know, the best memories are just all of the players that you work with over and over again. And that's going to be whether it's club ball, college ball, whatever it is, I think. You know, it's something I've done over the time as well as I've been a volunteer coach for UCO for many years. I did that. That's really what gave me kind of an end to UCO to begin with, to get our national training site there is that I was a volunteer assistant for the head coach that then moved from the head coach that was then overseeing the wellness center, which is where we're housed now. And they're the ones that we worked with to come up with that plan. But, you know, through that volunteer with UCO and stuff, it's just those players you come in contact with. I had a player text me you know, just yesterday that I hadn't heard from in, I don't know, this has probably been 10 years or more. And just out of the blue, you know, just saying, hey, Coach Bill, I want to thank you for what you did. And, you know, just things like that, you know, and those are the payoffs.
That's cool.
Yeah. The kind of things that you're doing it for, you know, and you're involved with and that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's kind of like with the sitting program. I never dreamt that I would be with the program as long as I have been. But, it, you know, it was one of those things that got involved with it, got involved with the players, and it just went over my heart. And one of those things that I continue to, well, how can I better serve an underserved community? And even though we've had success, I still think they're underserved.
Yeah.
So it's trying to develop that and, promote that, that people even understand the sport, all that kind of stuff on that side. But so the successes, like I said, are there, whether it be for club ball, I really never coached high school until I was actually coaching. It was part time with the sitting program, but there was a local high school that got into a problem with a coach or something, that 2 weeks or so before their season was going to start, that they need to find a head coach. And, at that time, all the coaches are already wrapped up, their programs. So I had a friend of mine that I guess the AD of that school had reached out to, that somehow passed along my name. And I got permission from the church that I was working with at the time, that they said, you can work it out with all that. Go for it. Yeah, I thought it'd be a one-time deal. And, I ended up coaching there 4 or 5 years, but that first year we were able to win a state tournament. And
awesome.
Won two state tournaments there in a row, and then two runners up. So it was like, those kind of successes, though, like I said, kind of stand out to you, that, again, it's the players you work with and stuff like that. But when you have a little bit of success, it's just icing on the cake. I see a lot of really, really good coaches across the U.S., but they just haven't been afforded to be in the right place at the right time. And, sometimes, for whatever reason, everything comes together and you're put in the right place at the right time. That's kind of the way I look at it in some of these situations. So it's been good.
That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. This kind of goes into this a little bit, but how cool is it to be coaching the women's sitting team and coaching athletes long enough to see them become parents, to become business owners, to just become incredible people outside of, athletics, outside of playing the sport. For example, Kaleo, you've coached, I think, or even known since she was really little. Can you talk a little bit about that? Just, you mentioned a lot of athletes coming back from maternity leave recently. Players getting married, becoming business owners, it's really cool, the things that they do off the court. So could you talk a little bit about that and how rewarding that is for you?
That's the part you get wrapped up in all these players' lives. And you mentioned Kaleo. She's just an example of some of that, where she actually started training with us in the sitting program at 12. But the way we knew about her was she was involved in our club program.
Right.
And, that's how she got started, kind of through the processes and, the whole thing of, she turned 16 years old at her first Paralympic Games in London.
Wow.
And, she's playing on the team with 30 and 40 year olds. That's a huge age gap and or culture gap. I mean, it's like things she's interested in is nowhere near what, these 30 and 40 years old are. So trying to work those details out and stuff, and trying to push her, hey, you've got to find your voice. You're good enough to be on this team. You're good enough to be on the court, but you've got to make sure that those other players know that you're good enough to be on this. You know, it's just the, all that kind of development to the place where she is now, that she's the, you know, she's a silent but vocal leader on the team for sure. A lot that she does, but yeah, you know, seeing her development as far as the sport, you know, being at her wedding, being at the hospital at her first birth, and you know, just all those kinds of things mean a lot. And I've been able to do that with a lot of players. You know, being able to go to the weddings and help them in thought processes with, like you said, developing job perspectives and other things like that, whether it be for nonprofits or, you know, other business sides of things or whatever. I mean, and it goes beyond the women as well. You know, I've been not only coach the guys, but I'm around the men's program all the time and, you know, oversee the program. So very, very close to a lot of those guys as well. And I've seen a lot of change in their lives, a lot of things going on from, you know, when they first started playing, when they meet a potential spouse, get married, you know, all those types of things. And it's reversed as well. So, you know, whenever I met my current wife, you know, I had one of the women's team players, when she met Debbie, my wife, she was like, "Hey, I want to know what your intentions are with our coach." You know, so
I love that.
So it goes both ways. Yeah.
That's so cool. Yeah. Awesome to hear those stories and kind of see them from afar. You know, I'm social media manager at USA Volleyball, so I see all the wedding pictures, you know, all the new babies that are coming out. Congratulations to Katie and Jillian as well, Jillian. Most recently. Yeah. But kind of want to switch gears a little bit here. We've talked a lot about your background, just so much that you've been involved in, and Oklahoma is lucky to have you with the community there, and you clearly have a passion and energy for volleyball and starting programs there. And yeah, just want to say thank you for all you've done with Oklahoma and growing the game there. But kind of moving into this current season here, we talked about it before. You're coming off back-to-back Paralympic gold medals. What are some of the challenges you kind of foresee as we get ready, gearing up for the Paris Games coming up next year?
Yeah, you know, I think, well, the biggest challenges are the other teams, but
right.
you gotta prepare for them. You know, there's a level that you have to play at to win medals, and you can get to that level and still not win medals. You have to have some things fall and go your way. You got to peak at the right time, you know, and so everything you do is trying to build a system and the culture that pushes you in a way so that you don't peak too early. You're peaking at the right time. You know, that belief system in the team and the structures there, those types of things. You know, we've had a lot of success, but, you know, with that success is also one of those things of, what do you do to continue to motivate? What do I do to continue to motivate myself? What do I do to continue to motivate our other staff, to motivate our players? At one point, it was, hey, we want to win a gold medal. Well, I can't use that anymore. You know, now we can't say, well, you want to win another gold medal, but it doesn't quite have the same drive.
Right.
And so it's trying to find what those motivating factors are, not just as a team, but for those individual athletes and why they're involved. Why are you still involved with the program? What are you trying to accomplish? What do you want to do? How does it affect you personally? Those types of things, so that, you know, we can try to get them to the place we need to be so that they're playing at the highest level that they can play at. So I think there's a lot that goes into that. It's also difficult to stay at a high level of play for a long period of time. You know, I look at the women's team and I look at, you know, since 2009, the level of success that we've had, it really just astounds me some that the players have been able to have the continuous success over and over again every year. And that's regardless of, I mean, we've had, you know, one or two undefeated seasons, which, you know, you don't play for, but it happens. We've had a couple of just one or two match losses, which is tough as well. You know, but up until the World Championships last year, the women had not placed lower than second place in any tournament that they'd ever been in since 2009. That's an incredible stat. And yeah. I give it to the players to say they figured a way out to continue to make themselves continue to push to play the game and to try to get better and for us to produce. So I put a lot of hope and trust in that as well, as we still try to look at, you know, are the systems of play that we use to win Tokyo going to help us to be able to win in Paris? Or what do we need to tweak? What are those changes we need to make? You know, because if we have some personnel changes, those types of things. You know, when we didn't have Katie playing and Jillian was out and we had some other key players that were out for injuries or whatever, you know, we had to rely on some of these new athletes. Mackenzie Franklin was one of those that was very, very new to the program. And well, we kind of looked at her, good athlete, played some volleyball, but we needed her because of her size and some other things. Hey, we got to get you up to speed fast, you know, and she's done a really good job, you know, in her progressions with the team. And we've just had to rely on her, you know, as well as some of the other players. You know, you take somebody like, you know, Emma that, you know, she'd been playing a while, but had been more of a backup role because she's a hitter. We have some really good hitters that were in front of her. But, you know, she made the Tokyo roster. We used her as a serving specialist. And lo and behold, what happens? She comes in at match point and serves an ace.
So, cool.
You know, those are those types of things you look at. And it's like, all right, how do we continue to build off of that as well and rely upon that? You know, and now for like Emma, you know, she was going to college. Now she's moved here and is in the resident program. So we're asking a lot of her that way as well. So, it's just trying to put all those pieces together of the players and here's how we want to train. Here's the things we need to train on. Here's some of our weaknesses. How do we address them? Here's our strengths. How can we make those strengths more of an advantage? What are some of those things that our opponents are doing? And we need to be looking at that on how are we going to address that to counteract that? And what are on the Paralympic side, trying to find tournaments to play in and have tournaments is difficult a lot of times. So trying to put together a 2024 schedule, boy, I'm still working on it. I mean, it's really difficult, but trying to piece that together and going like, all right, we're playing enough to keep us on edge, to be ready to perform at the Paralympics. And those are just all those things that you, that go into the season.
I want to check in with you really quick. Are you still good on time? Do you have anything coming up?
I'm good. I do a little bit later on, but we're good so far.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. Cause I have a few more things that we want to get to and having a great conversation with you right now. So I want to make sure that we, aren't bumping into your busy schedule.
Sure. You know, and on the men's side, they're still working to get qualified for Paris, but it's in the kind of the same boat there. It's even though I'm not the head coach, you know, I work with Greg and their staff on, hey, what do we got to do? What are some of those changes we need to make? You know, how can we implement that? What can we do to make a stronger schedule for you next year? So we kind of try to build in to have you at least peaking when you need to. You know, we can never say, you know, whether you do qualify or you don't qualify. It's all a matter of, hey, are you playing your best to be able to qualify? You know, it's kind of the same way with that medal I talked about. It's all you can do is peak and play at your best. Yeah. And then you got to have some breaks and get some, you know, advantage at some places like that, some things to try to win. So we're trying to look for that on the men's side as well.
Diving into your Paralympic memories here, and you mentioned a really fun one with Emma coming in as a serving sub to help you win that gold medal in Tokyo. But what other favorite memories do you have that stand out to you that you kind of look back on often? I wasn't in Rio, but seeing the video of you just coming off the sideline as you guys won your first gold medal, fist pumping and celebrating with the team and your fellow coaches is a fun memory for me, at least as a viewer, as a fan. But yeah, what sort of memories stand out to you?
Well, there's a lot of memories there. You know, I mean, it's kind of like the Yama story. The interesting background part of that is not only, you know, we were in the fourth set, and we had an okay lead, but it's like, all right, things are kind of getting tight. Michelle Goodall was, you know, my assistant there. I leaned over to her. I was like, boy, it'd be nice to finish it right here. And then lo and behold, you know, she serves that ace. And we didn't do anything. We just kind of looked at each other, and it was like, we won, you know. It was kind of surreal there, kind of a thing. But I also can remember back to, you know, my first Paralympics in Athens, with the men's program. You know, it's just going to a games itself is an experience in itself, but also for me, going and being able to see the Paralympic sports. So, you know, not only us playing, but them being able to watch, wheelchair basketball, blind soccer, just all kinds of sports like that. I was just dropping, you know, my jaw going like, how in the world do they do that? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm still doing that. I do it with our players all the time. I mean, I've been with them a long time, but they're still, I go, how did they just do that? But that was a huge experience for me, you know. Then London, where we got a silver medal, you know, it was my first medal. We really wanted that gold. We felt like we could get it. You know, we just fell a little short there. We were majorly bummed about that. And I think myself and the team, you know, there was some depression there for a good 2 or 3 months.
Of course, yeah.
That memory burns in you, though, you know. But then you go to, we were working hard, getting ready for Rio. We've had a lot of success. World championships that year. We actually were hitting for match point against China to win the world championship. We don't get it scored, end up losing, you know, in the fifth set by two to them. So we're right there on the edge. Then we go to, there's a tournament, it was called the Intercontinental Cup. And it was actually in China. We go there, we beat China for that tournament. You know, it's the same year as Rio. So then, so I think it was that convincing point. Yes, we can do this. you know, we knew we could. We've proved it. You know, we get into Rio. We play in our pool match, real close match, but lose to China.
Yep.
And, you know, we're thinking, I think we came out of that saying, thinking, God, we gave that away. But, hey, we lost, you know. That memory, though, is, yeah, not just winning that gold medal, it's how we won that gold medal in Rio. I mean, we beat China in three sets, dominating them. And those, you know, that was the first match that they had ever lost in a Paralympic Games.
Wow. I don't think I knew that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And so to not only win it, but to win it in that fashion, I think made a statement. And I think that's a sweet memory. You know, it goes along with the Paralympics, but it's almost in any of these tournaments, but especially on that stage. The memory of watching your flag being raised and the national anthem being played,
right,
is something you'll never forget. I mean, it brings tears to my eyes right now. To represent your home country and to be able to accomplish something that a lot of people in the U.S. want you to accomplish, but is very, very difficult to do. That's just a huge thing. That's a huge memory as well. Take that to go to Tokyo, you know, with COVID and all that. You know, a lot of people don't know the background for us on that, that 3/4 of our roster had to wait to come to Tokyo because COVID exposure, you know, so they arrived 2 days before we play our first match, you know, and we're just trying to stick together and go from that point to, okay, we're playing okay. We're not playing great, but, you know, we're just, let's get a little bit better every match. A lot of people also didn't know this, besides China being in our pool, we had Russia in our pool.
Yeah.
And Russia was the, you know, was the world champions. And so we're like, yeah, it's a pretty difficult pool. We're able, you know, we lose to China in three, really wasn't close. We beat Russia, though, to get into the bracket play crossovers. And we're able to beat Brazil there. And we're continuing to play a little bit better every time. And then we get into that the match with China, gold medal match. But like I said, we really hadn't played our best through that whole tournament. It was maybe 3 or 4 points in. I looked over at Michelle and I'm like, they're here to play tonight, you know. And that first set, we sided out, I want to say it was close to 80-90%.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it's like, well, when you're passing and siding out like that, you're not going to lose. So it just kind of showed that that was the level they raised themselves to play in that match. And that helped us to win that tournament, win the gold medal. But it was the memory for me is seeing them overcome all that they had to overcome to come to that point and knowing we really hadn't played our best to then see, hey, they're here. They're present and they're giving it everything that they have. That's just a huge, huge thing to see as a coach.
That's so cool. I love hearing these stories from you.
We would have, you know, I would have taken the silver knowing, hey, they're giving it all they got out there on the court, playing their best. Fortunately, it was good enough to win the gold. But, you know, you know, the key for me was just saying they're doing it.
Yeah, love these stories from you and just seeing the emotions that you're showing here, especially when you were talking about the anthem. And what people might not know is only one anthem is played in the medal ceremony, and that's the gold medal. So when you hear that, you know, you did something special, and you know, everything you did to get to that moment just, you know, is elevated that much more when you hear that anthem playing and the flag raised. So, yeah, thank you so much for sharing those. Favorite memories. I love hearing the China rivalry too. I remember an interview with Heather Erickson when she said, I think it was before Rio, she said, "We want China in the finals." And I know we played that, we blasted that on social media and a lot of videos, because that was just such a cool moment and soundbite for that. It's
been a long-standing rivalry for sure.
Yep. Kind of, you know, going into World Cup coming up, you know, back-to-back gold medals, you have qualified for the Paris Games. Does that take any of the pressure coming off of this tournament, or, you know, is it just kind of business as usual? How are you kind of preparing for the World Cup?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of business as usual, but like I said, getting Katie back, getting, you know, some other players in that we've not had and stuff, it's an opportunity for us to perform. And it is a little bit change in some of the systems. A lot of people don't know that, like in May at the zone championships where we won, we went to a 6-2 format, and which is not something that, you know, we had done. You know, we're looking at a 5-1 probably again going into the World Cup, but we definitely still have the 6-2 as a backup. But it's those kinds of things. Some of that maybe as usual, but it's trying to see, hey, where are we at now? How can we perform? That's kind of where we're at going into it. Also, it would be the first time we get to see China since Tokyo because of COVID and stuff like that as well. So, you know, there's a lot to that, but in some ways, like you said, it is business as usual. Here's how we prep. Here's what we do. Here's how we get ready for it. You know, what are the key elements that are different for this tournament? You know, there's some uniqueness having to go to Egypt, food, water, other things, you know, so it's all those type of things you prepare for, but it's, hey, when you get here, you have to play. And so, is trying to get all those things out of the way so you can't play.
Tournament's coming up in November. I don't know if we know for sure if it's being streamed yet or not. I don't know if you know that yet or not, but hopefully it's streamed.
Yeah. I don't know yet or not, but usually they try to stream those. So we'd pass it along. You know, I mean, there is also the question. We don't know what's happened with the tournament on some levels because of the recent war outbreak there.
Of course, yeah.
In Israel and stuff. And it's only 300 miles away from Cairo. So there's a lot of apprehension right now with a lot of countries and some stuff. So we're kind of in a holding pattern on some things as well. But
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah. Keep us in the loop if you do get that stream. I'm sure, you know, BJ's on top of it as well, and we'll find that. But for those listeners who may not have watched sitting volleyball and at this level, you know, with the World Cup or Paralympics, why should they want to tune in, and what should they be looking for to get out of, you know, watching, you know, specifically the women's sitting team that you're coaching?
Well, yeah, I think part of that is just so that it's the knowledge of being able to know what the game is about and what level it can be played at. I think for most people in the U.S., when you say sitting volleyball, they have a picture in their mind that they think of almost like, well, isn't this great that there's this game for these disabled athletes and, you know, they sit on the floor and play or whatever. And it's nothing like that, as you would know. You know, I mean, these are very, very high level athletes that just happen to have a physical disability and they've overcome that. The level at which the game is played is super phenomenal. And if people actually see it, then they go like, oh, man, there's no way that they're doing that for us to be able to run a back row center, you know, where our center's coming off the back row and still, you know, running our offense and stuff like that with as fast as the game is. And that's the other side, that our players have to think so quick and react so quick. I mean, the standing game is fast, sitting game is faster.
Yep.
And that's part of what makes it fun to play. But I think those are the unique parts of that game that people could tune in and to see. And it's also one thing to see it like that, but then it's even another thing to go see it live and then go like, holy cow, it's even faster than I thought. And then it's even one step more to sit down and try it. And then you have an appreciation to go, there's no way. I don't know how they do it, because it's next to impossible. But it just shows what great athletes can do when they set their minds to it.
Yeah, sit down and play. You'll be sore in places you didn't know existed the next day, but you're going to have a blast doing it. And like you mentioned, seeing it live in person too, we have, there's a couple opportunities a year, open nationals included, qualifiers that you go and do exhibition matches as well. If you see that, stop and watch them play. They usually, you know, the team usually does meet and greets afterwards. You can meet the players, maybe even sit down and pepper with them as well. But those courts, they're standing room only when you walk by them. It's a lot of fun to watch. Don't miss your match. Don't miss your match before you go and play. but sit down and watch and stay a while. It's a good time, and you'll get a lot out of it. Staying in to current day right now, but new assistant coach Leo has come in and taken over Michelle Goodall's position. What does Leo bring to the team? Kind of looking ahead to World Cup and next year at the Paralympic Games.
Leo is a little bit different makeup than the rest of our staff in that, and some people don't know, he actually played professionally standing, and he was actually on the Brazilian national team for a while. So he has that understanding and mindset of what do you have to do to play at that level? And then he also was an assistant coach with the Brazilian men's sitting team for a while before, him and his family moved here to the U.S. So he also has a good grasp of the sitting game as well. And so it's that, he's been a part at a high level as a player and as a coach. He also worked with the National League program there in Brazil for a while, and with the sitting program. So you bundle all that together, and from a coaching perspective, he brings a lot to the table, way more than what I have. I mean, I've been in the game a long time. I've seen it. I have things that I understand about that, the kinesthetic parts of it, movements, all that kind of stuff. But some of those key elements that he has, I just don't have that knowledge base. And so that's a really nice thing to have in your gym.
That's awesome. Well, excited to watch the World Cup coming up and, of course, cheer on the team as they head to the Paralympic Games next year. It's going to be a lot of fun and a lot of exciting things ahead for the program.
Looking forward to it.
Really quick before I let you go, want to get to know a little bit more about you. Off the court, take the coaching hat off. What sort of hobbies, interests do you have outside of volleyball? Maybe fishing. Is fishing a big hobby for you? I might have heard.
I don't know. Where'd you hear that? I like to do. I mean, a lot of people don't know. I love photography as well, specifically more wildlife and nature photography. So I actually taught classes down in Costa Rica for a while on how to use photography for ecological purposes. So I really enjoy that as well. But that gives me the insight. I just love nature. So hiking, fishing, those types of things, I like doing. Fishing's probably a passion for me as well. Most any kind, I like doing it. Do a lot of bass fishing, crappie fishing on the lakes here, but I also like to fly fish. So we have a couple of different streams that we can fly fish here in the state, but also usually take a trip once a year to Arkansas to fish on the White River or some of the tributaries there. I've fished there in Colorado quite a bit, fly fishing, and New Mexico as well. So, try to get around, do a little bit of that. One of these days, when I retire, the hope is grab a trailer, hit the road. My wife and I can just fish our way across the U.S. So,
oh, that's cool. I've always wanted to fly fish or learn how to fly fish. So you'll have to come next time you're out in Colorado, maybe take a couple extra days and we'll get the podcast group out and you can teach us how to fly fish. That'd be awesome.
I don't know how good of a teacher I am, but yeah, I can try. That'd be another one. Kessel I'd probably be better at.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We'll get Kessel out too. That'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, maybe that's, even on his property there. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Got two beaver pods there in the fish.
That's right. Do you still do I know a few years back you brought some peppers out. Do you still do any of that?
Still got the garden going.
Still got the gardening.
Part of the outdoor type stuff. It's not just like vegetables. I just love to garden. So flowers.
Oh, cool.
Love planting and taking care of those, landscaping, that kind of stuff. But yeah, have a small raised bed garden that, we do asparagus and tomatoes and, carrots and potatoes and a lot of different things. But yeah, a lot of different kind of peppers as well. So yeah, if I could get to Colorado quick, I could probably bring you some. I just brought a bunch in.
Awesome.
They're growing big time right now. Yeah, before the last freeze hits them and knocks them out.
Yeah, that was a nice surprise. I actually used them in a chili that I made. So that was a lot of fun to have the fresh peppers from your garden. So thank you for that.
Yeah. I enjoy doing that. And it's funny because I don't like hot peppers myself, but I love growing them. So
you give them out to everyone else to kind of burn their mouths out. Now.
Give a lot of them away. Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. That's awesome. Bill, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with me. Is there anything else that we kind of left on the table or anything else you'd like to share or talk about before I let you go here?
Not anything big. I do think it's people need to understand about all of our Olympic and Paralympic sports that our teams receive no funding from the federal government, and that's for any of our Olympic or Paralympic teams. So unlike most other countries where they have a Department of Sport, they get tax dollars that go in there that helps fund all of their sports organization. In the U.S., we get zero from the government. So all of the funding comes from corporate dollars, from private dollars, things like that. Either through the ESOPC or through the national governing bodies. So like our funding comes from the U.S. Olympic Paralympic Committee and from USA Volleyball. And I say that to say because I think there's a misguided understanding. Well, all these teams have all the money that they need, and that's not true. In fact, the U.S., most teams are probably way underfunded compared to most other countries. So it kind of also shows that we've had to do a lot on a little to get the great success that we've had across all sports. And So that's something I try to talk about when I'm talking to college classes and anywhere else, so that they really understand that, you know, what can they do? That individual donor makes a big difference for all of us.
For sure. Yeah. Thank you for shedding some light on that and sharing that to our listeners. Thank you. Really quick. Also, before I let you go, if there's someone out there who, you know, is interested in sitting volleyball, maybe interested in coaching, or, you know, maybe even a player who is interested in playing sitting, where can they, you know, what's the route to start that? Where can they reach out to you?
Yeah, the easiest way is just to go to the USA Volleyball website and then go to the sitting page, and it'll have links and all that kind of stuff. I mean, they can always email me or email Elliot is usually where we start with athletes and some stuff like that as well. So that, you know, Elliot.Blake@USAV.org or mybill.hammeter@USAV.org is our email. So, but if you can't remember it, go to the USA Volleyball website and look for the sitting volleyball space.
Awesome.
And also could be on Facebook, I guess, and got to get the social media push there as well.
There you go. Yeah. Find us on social media. You can message us there as well. We'll point you in the right direction. Yeah. But yeah, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us. Good luck at World Cup and the Paralympics coming up next year.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Of course. Thank you.
All right.
Talk to you later. Bye. Awesome conversation with Bill. I've known Bill for close to 10 years now, ever since I started at USA Volleyball. And a lot of that I did not know, you know, from his background to, you know, starting the programs in Oklahoma, club programs in Oklahoma, to, you know, his early beginnings with the sitting team, sitting programs. And love hearing, you know, just the full journey and everything that he's been involved in. And definitely a highlight, just, you know, hearing him talk about how rewarding it is to, you know, be with the program so long, you know, long enough to, you know, go to his players' weddings, you know, see them become parents and business owners and all that. So not only, you know, rewarding seeing their accomplishments on the court, but off the court as well. And yeah, definitely appreciate all the stories and the conversation that Bill shared with us. But, you know, thank you again to Bill for taking some time to talk with us ahead of World Cup, both men's and women's sitting teams. You can follow them on Instagram at @USAV_sitting_MNT and the women's team at @USAV_sitting_WNT. Definitely stay tuned to those accounts as well as at USA Volleyball on social media. And you can follow along at usavolleyball.org for all competition updates. But let's keep things moving. Let's move into the upcoming events. Over on the USA Volleyball Beach Tour side, we have the Florida Region Halloween Regional Qualifier, October 22nd in St. Pete Beach, Florida. And the North Texas Region Mad San Volleyball Regional Qualifier, October 22nd in Plano, Texas. Good luck to everyone competing in those events. And shout out to all the USAB region setting up and hosting those events. More details on all upcoming events can be found at usavolleyball.org. Now, over on to the pro side of things. We have the Beach Pro Tour Futures Women Only, October 18th through the 22nd in Mallorca, Spain. The Beach Pro Tour Challenge, October 19th through the 22nd in Goa, India. The Pan American Games, October 21st through the 28th in Santiago, Chile. The Beach Pro Tour Futures Men Only, October 25th through the 29th, also in Mallorca, Spain. And the Beach Pro Tour Challenge, October 26th through the 29th in the Maldives. Good luck to everyone, all of our national team athletes competing in those events. And lastly, the Zonal and Local Officiating Camp October 27th through the 29th in Huntington Beach, California. A great opportunity, a great event for aspiring officials to learn from experts both in classroom and on the stand. You can register today for that at usavolleyball.org. Remember, listeners, you can rate and review, share with friends, family, teammates. It really helps this podcast grow and reach new listeners. And check out our video episodes now on our website and YouTube channel. We thank you all for your continued support. Do you know a club that should be featured or a story that you'd like us to share? You can email us at the USAB show at usab.org. Leave us feedback. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know about any future topics that you'd like us to share. We really want to hear from you. New episodes drop every other week. And until next time, this is the USA Volleyball Show, the official podcast of USA Volleyball.
This has been the USA Volleyball Show with Clarence Hughes and Stephen Munson, produced by Curtis Ward. Our content producer is Laura Fawcett. Our marketing lead is Bree Jaycox. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to rate and review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the USA Volleyball Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.